everyone, and thanks for joining me again for a new episode of the Talk Music Podcast. This is yet another really fun chat I enjoyed recently. I also had the pleasure of co-hosting this with Harry Pawurka, who's a long-lost friend. Harry and I went to high school together, and as it turns out, he was a member in a band with our guest. The guest we are both grilling today is surely one of the best bassists around, and his musical portfolio is truly impressive. Jeff Jones is my guest, and he has performed with Tom Cochran and Red Ryder for most of their career, and still does. And he has also played bass for Burton Cummings for many years, and still goes out with Burton currently. He's also worked with Molly Johnson and the Infidels, Lawrence Gowan, Ronnie Hawkins, and he had a monster hit with his first band, Ocean. And so it's really a pleasure to welcome Jeff Jones. Hi, Jeff, and welcome to the Talk Music Podcast. Okay, so it takes a lot to impress me. I've been around for quite a while in the biz, but after reading about your career and your long-standing involvement with some of this country's most iconic acts, not only was I super impressed, but I genuinely got really excited to do this. So thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it, Tom.
Let's say hi to our wonderful co-host, Harry Pawurka, who's lurking on the other screen here. Harry is a stellar musician, songwriter, and somebody I actually went to high school with, Oakwood Collegiate in Toronto, to be exact, which was many, many moons ago. And I don't think I want to mention how many moons, as it kind of scares me to mention the figure. I might astonish myself again and fall off my chair here, because it's been a long time, right, Harry?
What, almost 60 years?
Oh, he's going to mention it. Oh, shit. Oh. Oh, shit. You shouldn't have. I was trying to avoid that. Okay, everybody knows now. All right, we can't pretend we're 55 anymore. Okay, so Harry, I don't even know that much about your musical history. And before we start grilling Jeff, you were also really active musically at the same time as Jeff and I were getting going. So let's dig into your past for a bit. You actually have a Rush connection, and that's because your band Mornington Drive was managed by Ray Daniels. And let's mention, everybody who doesn't know who Ray Daniels is, Ray Daniels did end up being Rush's manager for their entire career. So tell us a little bit about that time period and maybe a highlight or two about how that came together with you and Ray. And you also headlined Ontario Place, from what I've read, which is a big deal.
It really was.
Yeah.
Well, Ray Daniels picked us up when we first came down from Midland, and he had just at that time, he just had Mornington Drive and Rush. And just to make a long story short, obviously we went through a couple years with him, and Rush really started to take off. So he was pushing Rush a lot, and we sort of didn't feel that we were getting the same type of attention. So we went to another manager, William Ten. Skinny,
yeah, sure.
Yeah, everybody knows Skinny, who managed Flood at that time. And because we had the family connection with Steve Pilling in our band and the Pilling brothers in Flood, it was a no-brainer to go that way. At that point, our band started to really take off and did really well. And like you said, we headlined Ontario Place, and we had a band called Simon Kane open for us, who was a recording act. And they couldn't figure out why they were opening for us. And it was because the promoter says, well, look at the people. There's 12,000 people. They all came to see Mornington Drive. We had a huge following. Never recorded. Well, we did record, but it was never released.
That was my next question. With 12,000 people, that's massive amount of people that would have been interested in your recording. And, you know, that could have spread from Ontario Place sideways across the country. So you never got that far.
No, we never got a contract for recording. We finally did go into Phase One Studios and recorded a song called One Way Ticket to the Blues, because Miles Goodwin took a liking to us, and he got us into and tried to get us under Aquarius.
Okay.
But it all went for naught, and it never got released, so we kind of disbanded after that.
Well, at least you can say you've headlined Ontario Place. That's a big deal, and worked with Rush's manager, which is another big deal. Okay, and then you did not enter the music biz then officially. You went into another profession, of course, and You just told me recently that you were active again writing and recording songs, but with actually somebody called Howard Helm, who was from the band Zahn. And how's that going?
Oh, with Howard, it's phenomenal. Like I tapped into Howard when I started this about 2 years ago. I started writing. I had a few songs that were lingering from after Morgan Dry broke up. I just went through this crazy phase where I was starting to write. And so I pulled some of those songs out and redid them in the studio. And I wanted a couple of the songs to be very dominated by keyboards. And the first guy that came to my mind was Howard, because I've known him for, well, just about that long as well. And he jumped at it and he said, absolutely.
Well, I'm going to throw you a big compliment here. I've heard some of that music, and I actually hear some hit songs there. If anybody's interested, although it's almost impossible to have a hit these days, but, you know, we'll get to that later, perhaps. So congratulations on doing that, and please keep putting them out there.
All the world loves a dreamer. He agreed to go on. All the world loves a dreamer.
So, Harry, you and Jeff are also friends. Without going into too deep how you guys met and all that, how do you know each other from the past?
Well, you want to take this, Jeff, or do you want me to?
Well, I'm going to track back. There were like so many connections that we had, and some of them being William Ten. I was managed by him briefly when I was not in Red Rider any longer in the late 80s. But so I was working on original music, but he decided that Peter Cash? What's the other Cash brother?
Andrew Cash.
Andrew Cash. He put his eggs in Andrew Cash.
Okay.
And we parted company. My writings were not.
So this was in the 80s, because we're going to get there, because we're going to go through your career shortly. So
I met Jeff through a mutual friend who went to school with all the guys from Thorncliffe Park and Leaside High School, whatever. And I don't even remember exactly how our band, The Great Lactic Acid, was formed, but somehow, you know, it got together.
So, Jeff, can you vouch you were in Lactic Acid?
I remember everything about it like it was yesterday. Oh, and incidentally, you Oakwood Collegiates.
Yes.
My son, who is now 34 years of age, I'll give that up. I'll give up the age.
okay.
He was also an attendee. That was the one high school that he started and finished in, was Oakwood.
That's right.
And here's another one. That's interesting news. And here's another one for you. I didn't know, but Bob Ezrin also attended there. I don't think I ever bumped into him. I think he's maybe a couple of years older, two or three or something like that. So, but he also went to that school. So thank you for that little tidbit. So Lactic Acid, so that was that, what a name. I mean, to name your band after a fluid that rips through your body all day long. That's a questionable name for me, but.
you made that name up, didn't you, Jeff?
No, I think it was John Plant.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Right?
Yeah. You know, that is the era of goofy names when we were all starting out. There was a lot of them. So I'll put that one in there. For me, it was a bit goofy. But
I don't think we fully realized what it meant. You know, I didn't realize at the time what lactic acid actually was. We just, it sounded cool.
Well, I can verify, because I have a lot of it when I play tennis and I'm always trying to get rid of it. So I can verify that it's fluid that goes through us like every day, and I'm always trying to get rid of it. So anyway, okay. So Jeff, why don't we start, we'll keep things simple here, and we'll start by winding our way chronologically through your illustrious career. Let's start with, where were you born and what was your childhood like? As I read, your dad was actually a monster jazz musician.
Yes, I was born in Chicago, and where my dad was actually He was a jazz musician working out of Chicago and mostly in the Chicago area. He didn't travel much because he had a family, so he kept to the local scene. And he did some recording on some of those songs that, you know, like, who was it? Mary Wells, My Guy, a bit of stuff like that, Chess Records. He was the B pianist there. They had like a wrecking crew. And if some of the guys, you know, were drunk and didn't show up or whatever, he would get the call and then go and cut the track. And he never told us till many years later what the songs were that he played on, because as a jazz musician, he was embarrassed to have played on such, you know, crass pop R&B. Yeah. But he ran with like Errol Garner and, you know,
Oscar Peterson, from what I think he was around that time too.
Yeah. And Oscar was a visitor at our home when I was 5, 6, 7 years old. He and Ray Brown used to drop over and have dinner with my mom and dad.
Incredible.
And they were fabulous guys. And every piano player said, wow, this is really great. I'm pretty good, but none of us will ever be Oscar.
No, I hear you. So yeah. That must have had a profound effect on you as a kid growing up. So did that start resonating through you, seeing your dad and how much joy he got out of it? Or was it not related so much and you would have probably followed it going into music anyway?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think that... you know, having music around that much and meeting guys that were that heavy, I had no idea how heavy they were. But it must have had some resonance because, yeah, I certainly picked that up. But I got to say, what I see as the turning point for me getting involved in the show business, going to the Schubert Theater and seeing the first stage production of Sound of Music before it was, like, I had gone to see Count Basie in a club. I went to the Schubert Theater twice and saw the Sound of Music before the movie hit with Julie Andrews. It was still a stage play. And I got the opportunity to go. And the second time, stand in the wings when the production was on. So I'm like 5, 6, 7 maybe years old. And I'm in the wings and I've been in awe of this production. And, you know, the Ave Maria, it's a big scene. And oh my goodness. But when Ave Maria scene came up, there were like 30 or 40 actors, actresses dressed as nuns. And in this crowded backstage space, they're smoking cigarettes and calling each other filthy names. And it just made such an impression on me because I'm a fly on the wall. They don't see the little kid behind the curtain in the wing, but they are like foul-mouthed cigarette-smoking nuns.
Wow.
And I'm like, this is phenomenal. They had me thinking they were nuns. And so they're doing a really good job of acting.
What I'm amazed about is at such a young age, that having such an effect that you can just sort of probably go back to it right away mentally and go, oh, I really remember that moment in time, like you're just talking about. I'm really quite astounded. I can't remember anything I did at 7 years old or even maybe up till 10.
Yeah,
it was, vaguely. It was so huge. That, yeah, that's huge. So yeah. Interesting.
So, Jeff, how old were you roughly when you actually left Chicago and came to Toronto?
That was the summer of 66. I was 12 going on 13.
In 66?
Yes.
Really? So when was the lactic acid then?
67.
Well, you were older. How old were you? You were only 14 when you were lactic acid?
13 going on 14, yeah.
No way, really?
I bet you didn't know that.
Boy, I won't say anything about drinking in Thorncliffe Park then.
Yeah. Well, no one did that, did they?
No. So I spent a lot of time in Thorncliffe Park with you guys, and we rehearsed there and everything. What was it like there for you and going to Leaside High School? And how different was it here compared to Chicago?
Well, it was huge for me and my folks. We thought we had died and gone to heaven. It was so refreshing after Chicago with all the gang violence and bigotry and the whole thing. It was a rough place. Even though we didn't live in rough areas, there was the systemic racism was so profound that when I was in grade four, I moved from a school in an all-white neighborhood to a school in a mixed or predominantly black neighborhood, and I was skipped a grade. I skipped grade five and went straight to six because I had already had the curriculum that the black kids were going to get.
Oh, wow.
So they had already, it really made an impression on me because my parents were off the chart livid when you found out, and you would never have found out that you were getting a separate education.
I'm glad you touched on it because that was actually one of my questions. Like, given the sign of the times here, did you experience any racism? And you just answered that question.
Yeah. I'm not saying that Thorncliffe Park and Leaside were not without their incidents.
Compared to Chicago, it was like night and day.
Yeah. Yeah. There were no bricks coming through our window. A lot of the people that were that would be racist toward me, they were just curious and they didn't know anyone that wasn't white. I was one of two people of color in Leaside High School. It wasn't like Oakwood or anywhere else that I had been at that time. Black people really weren't here very much. That's when people from the Caribbean, a few years after that, started to relocate here.
See, and in the band, we never experienced that because, you were like, we're like brothers anyways.
Yeah.
So, you don't even think about it, or at least I didn't think about that at that point. I'm white, you're black. It just didn't come to fruition at all.
No, we didn't, and because of us sort of being, I guess you could say, on the forefront of making, rock music in a band, it wasn't that long after the Beatles.
Yeah.
And so people were so excited just to see us because we were so crazy and loud.
So it was Morning Drive. Lactic Acid is actually your first band then?
First band.
Okay, and I got something else here, something I didn't know about, and something the listeners are probably going to get a kick out of. You were the original bass player in Rush.
Yeah, I guess that would have been 68.
Yeah, because I left in 67. I went up north.
Yeah.
That's a newsworthy item right there. I'm glad you brought that up. I'd love to hear a bit more about that.
Well, there's different stories out there and people make stuff up, and I've seen all the hoopla online about it. And it's really not that much to me in terms of how much we didn't do anything. We played in Alex's mom's basement. We rehearsed and we played one, maybe two church community center basement. That was it. There was no recording. We weren't writing songs. We were, covering Zepp and Cream and Hendrix, and Geddy lived closer.
So that was the defining reason why.
That was it. Like, I was traveling up to Alex's a bus on Saturday afternoons. And one day we just were like, it's a bit of a trip, and I hear there's these other guys, Sean McIntosh, it was his name at the time. He now goes as Sean O'Shea. He and Jerry Fielding had a trio that was playing the same covers. So Alex was like, well, why don't you play with those guys and I'll get Getty to play with us? And that was that.
So you didn't get fired then from Rush. You just sort of moved on.
Yeah.
So I got it.
Yeah, that's my memory of it. People, I've heard other stories that don't really resonate with me. So,
well, we're getting it right straight from your mouth here, the actual truth of what really happened, because it's so interesting now to just think back. I actually was practicing also with my first band on Eglinton Avenue, and they actually had a rehearsal. They were sharing the basement with me. It was in around Oakwood and Eglinton. And I still remember bumping into them downstairs, going down the hallway. And I may have even bumped into you because I was also, you know, starting off. And I just remember rubbing shoulders with all of them. And then, of course, how many years later? I don't know, 50 years later, they, you know, what is it, one in a million or one in 10 million make it that far to that those heights? I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, well, I'm a one-hit wonder over and over, Tom.
Yeah, and we're going to get to that in a second. That's actually a really good segue. I like that. Okay, so Getty joins Rush, you leave, and then you end up in a band called Ocean. And you have a platinum hit called Put Your Hand in the Hand. What gives? You're just a teenager, like you're 18 or something. So how is it that you're hitting a home run, like in the music biz, at such an early age? I'd love to hear about how that transpired.
Yeah, I have no idea. It was just reckless stuff. And I thought I could do it. And they were older than I was. But the drummer, Chuck Slater, God rest his soul, we were jamming and stuff, and he said, you know, you should come and meet these people. They're looking for a bass player, and I think you could do it. And I said, but I'm 16. I'm not even 17 yet. And he said, well, let's just see what happens. And the next thing you know, we're rehearsing. We made the record that included Hand in the Hand. We were touring. I turned 17. That was September of 1970. And Hand in the Hand was just out a few weeks at that point. And so our first show was opening for Brutus and Edward Bear and Mash McCann.
Oh, terrific. What a bill. Larry Evoy.
Yeah. And then we played a show later. So in September, now the record was out and start, you know, it was so early. But we were opening for Bonnie and Delaney and Friends.
Oh, that was a big deal.
And that was a big deal. And Dave Mason was the guitarist subbing in for Eric Clapton.
Oh, wow.
And George Oliver's Natural Gas was second on the bill. And we were the opener. And it was my 17th birthday, Waterloo University.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but you couldn't even play bars because bars was 18, wasn't it? So well, you did you
yeah,
have
it was
to lie?
21. It was 21.
Oh, it was 21. So how... So. Were you just lying about your age, or were you when you played some of these?
We played mostly concerts.
Okay, and nobody paid attention what age you
were. And no one really cared. And everyone else was, when I was 17, everyone else was 23, 24, 25. And we didn't start playing any clubs until a couple of years later, but I was still underage.
Well, you realize you're in a very elite club here to have a hit at 17 or 18. That doesn't happen too often.
No.
At that age, there's probably going to, you know, be a handful only of you know, artists that's happened to. So, okay, so you have this massive hit. Now, is this one of these times where it was your first experience? Well, it would have been with a record label. And did you make a ton of dough, or did you make, or was it just kind of, well, you know, one of those bad record deals that existed that still exist?
That's exactly what happened, Tom. The deal was just signed out of a drawer in an office, and it had nothing in it for the artists, and we didn't write the song.
Right. Okay. So no publishing. McClellan, right.
Gene McClellan was the songwriter from Nova Scotia, and Anne Murray had actually already recorded the song, and Capitol Records didn't see it as a single for her. And boy, was she steamed when we came out with it. Because she had only had Snowbird up to that point and was looking to have another big single. And we came out with Hand in the Hand that we learned from her version.
So because it wasn't written by you guys, you probably didn't see a penny, I would assume, from so-called record royalties, which
we
can all laugh at that. A record royalties, do you never know anybody that's ever received a record royalty? Not many.
Well, I do know a couple.
But you do. I know a couple, but not more than that.
But what they had to go through to get that, their knees are bruised. But and the Canadian, I'm not going to throw names out, but the Canadian record company exec, who incidentally I have spoken to in recent years, who's still alive, he's older than myself, obviously, but he sold the rights to those records, the two albums that we did, Kama Sutra, which was Neil Bogart's label in America. And so the rights got traded off early on, and we were in the dark.
You know, there's a million stories like that, Jeff, where it's almost like you're trading baseball or hockey cards around.
Yeah.
Oh, here's your record that you made that you spent 2 years of your life promoting and blah, blah, blah. I'm just going to trade it over to this gentleman over here. I don't know. Just gave me a couple of bucks for it.
Yeah.
Harry, you have no idea the stories here that Jeff and I have gone through. So just stand by, because I'm sure there might be another story or two come up. The record company situation I've been through my whole life. And like I said, if there's a way to rip you off, they try to find a way. And it's creative accounting. I'll just leave it at that. There's very few honest gentlemen out there. There are some, for sure, and they know who they are. So
yeah.
There we go. That's my little spiel.
We went through the cycle of you know, having the hit, touring the world, had a second lesser hit called One More Chance, written by Roger Cook and Roger Greenaway, who wrote, I'd like to teach the world to sing.
That's right.
Those guys we became friends with at the Eurasia Song Festival, and they wrote this song for us. And it got charted on Billboard and stuff. But then all of a sudden, bingo, it disappeared. And no one knew why, but I think it was around the time that Neil Bogart took over. And all that we knew was our record that was climbing up the Billboard chart suddenly disappeared off the chart, couldn't get it played anywhere. And then we started to write other material and go to publishers and look for songs to try to resurrect ourselves, and no one was buying that. We couldn't get arrested.
So how long did things last then, Jeff, with Ocean? It was just literally a few years, right? 2 or 3 years?
We continued playing for 5 years.
Oh, you did? Okay.
We still toured. We still traveled. We hit a lot of B markets. It wasn't all bright lights and Eurasia Song Festival after the first couple of years. We were working and we were earning, like not huge, but we
were paying your bills is what
we were paying our bills
and, right, and having fun and doing playing. It
yeah, and people liked us because we weren't crappy, and yeah, so we went until 75 76. We had a couple of, you know, spurts at trying to reconfigure and continue, but by then I'm what, 20 21 22.
Yeah, and you've already played hundreds of shows, it sounds like, by that time.
and I'm burned and I want out.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
I don't know what the hell I'm going to do now.
After Ocean, did you hook up with Tom Cochran and Red Ryder?
There were a few stops in between there.
Like what?
The next stop was the day, and this was ironic, the day that we decided somewhere in Belleville or Brockville, in a hotel, to pack it in for once and for all. And we've dragged ourselves around and this name around and played the two songs a million times. We decided it's time for us to part company, forget about Ocean, let's move on with life. As soon as we made that decision, my phone rang in my hotel room. And it was Ronnie Hawkins.
I walk 47 miles of barbed wire, use a cobra snake for a necktie. Got a brand new house on the roadside, made from rattlesnake hide. I got a brand new chimney made on top, made from a human skull. Now come on, baby, let's take a little walk and tell me, who do you love? Who do you love? Who do you love? Who do you love?
Wow. I don't know how he knew. We did know him because we did some of our promo shots early on at his property in Mississauga. And so we knew Ronnie, and I knew him from playing at the Friars Tavern.
On Yonge Street there.
And my dad would play in the basement. Ocean would be on the main floor, and Ronnie Hawkins would be upstairs in the Nickelodeon. And we used to sort of run up and down the stairs because people would want to hear my dad, catch a set of Ocean, run upstairs and drink beer with Ronnie. It was wild. But he called me and he said, well, what are you doing? Do you want to, you know, he told me the same thing he told Robbie Robertson. He said, son, I can't pay you much, but you're going to get more pussy than Frank Sinatra.
Who's going to turn that down?
And he's like, well, I'd like to get paid. He's, oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Paid.
Pussy you first, know. Pay second.
but not, you know, but there's nothing like you with them gold records. And, you know, he's made it fun. And so I joined his band, and he said, yeah, and what about that keyboard fella, Greg Brown, God rest his soul, from Ocean? He was the band leader of Ocean. And he said, what about, I need a keyboard. Is that? And he was right with me. And so we joined Ronnie's band, which included King Biscuit Boy and Jack DeKaiser.
Jack DeKaiser, the Jack who's playing around like 500 shows a year, like he's everywhere these days. Wow. Which is great, yeah. For him. I didn't know this part of history.
Yeah.
This is so cool hearing this.
He and I were the young kids. And everybody was like, well, we got a couple of kids here, but well, boy, that Jack, he can sure pick, you know.
So how did the relationship with Tom Cochran start up?
Well, after the Hawkins experience, I lasted a year because I couldn't drink and drug and party as much as they could. A year was...
That's probably why you're still here, Jeff.
Yeah. I mean, like, I couldn't, because a lot of those people are not.
No, they're not.
Jack is. And Jack, you know, we've always been cool. You know, it was just a wild rock and roll freak show. And I couldn't continue to do that. And the other thing that got me out was Ronnie wanted to do a house gig in Edmonton in January and February for 8 weeks straight.
Say that again. Edmonton in January?
And February.
February. Oh, that's even worse. Oh, that's torture.
January and February.
Oh, that's an immediate no. Yeah.
That's not going to happen.
No. I totally concur with that one immediately.
So I ended up, I met a fella named Bernie LaBarge.
Yeah, still very active around town. Great player.
Yes. The Dexters. Bernie was a fantastic guitarist and voice. And we started this band called Stingery. And we had the other guitarist in the band was Brian Too Loud McLeod.
Oh, who ended up in the Headbins.
That's correct.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, he was a great rock player. Was, yeah.
So he was fresh from Newfoundland, where he had been a champion figure skater. But he came to Toronto, slinging guitar. We had this band. It was awesome because these two guys were unbelievably talented. But, you know, it was tough, and we're slugging it out in really bad club situations. And then Brian got the call to join Chilliwack.
Yeah, so out in Vancouver, probably.
Yeah. So there was no Headpins at that point, but he joined Chilliwack, and they asked him if he knew a bass player that he'd like to bring along, and he said, yeah, me. And they said, well, he doesn't look like he's from the West Coast. No, we're going to find somebody else.
What? Wow, what a comment to make. What are you supposed to look like from the West
Coast? Guess what that...
Yeah, I see the underlying theme there. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Not nice.
So, yeah, I found out. That's okay. So Bernie and I continued briefly without Brian. And we had a guy that was trying to be a manager, record company guy. And he had this contract that he wanted us to sign. But as soon as we started having him represent us, we had less and less jobs. So we weren't going to sign. But he was doing the same thing with a little band in North Toronto called Red Rider.
Okay.
It included Ken Greer, Peter Boynton, and a drummer, and the other guitarist, and the bass player. They were more into fusion. They were getting into jazz fusion, and they didn't want to play simple rocks, you know, pop, country folk music, but the guys wanted to start writing, you know, pop songs and
So Tom wasn't part of Red Rider yet, or was he?
No, well, he was about 2 weeks before me. So they were looking for someone to play guitar, sing, songwriter, didn't have to play solos or anything, just hold it down, and a bass player. And they didn't want to do fusion music. They wanted to write music that had harmony. And so they picked Tom and myself.
Okay, so you're literally there in the incarnation of the original band, like right as it's formed with Tom. You're right there at day one. Okay, that's very cool. Right place at the right time for you.
Yes.
And then you, I don't think it took you that long to get a deal with Capitol, did it?
No, very quickly, once the lineup was finalized and we showed a few songs, Dean Cameron was a lifelong ally of Tom.
Absolutely. I think he was maybe the biggest one they had. He was always there for the, for you guys, always.
And so once we had a handful of songs, we had a U.S. record deal.
Yes, and I, was the first album called Don't Fight It?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
And that, that had a massive hit called White Hot, which till this day stands the test of time.
Waiting by the shoreline in Semmelweis for your reply. I need you to come see me. That's no lie. The guns are getting closer. The sweat pours like the dew that fell from
track, and I think it was a pretty damn big hit.
Yeah, in Canada, but not in the U.S.
Okay, that that came later.
Yeah,
because you then was your second album called As Far as Siam?
Yes.
Okay, well there's my favorite monster hit, Lunatic Fringe, which, well, what can I say? That was huge and still is till this day. I hear it all the time. Even when I've traveled in the U.S. recently, I hear it on you know, AOR. That's
well, yeah. It was one of the most played songs on FM radio in the U.S. in 1982. Number one was "Start Me Up" by the Stones. Number two was "Lunatic Fringe," and number three was Bob Seger, "Hollywood Nights."
I got to ask, Jeff, now that you're dealing with all these big hit songs and everything, how was how exciting was the time period for you personally at that time?
Well, it was, yeah, it was all very exciting. And we, as Red Rider, we were fortunate that we actually were able to negotiate with the help of a lawyer. We didn't have management, but we negotiated a pretty good deal for ourselves on those that first group of records that we did. I was involved in four records. But the other side of it was we had producers that chose to spend huge amounts of money on the recordings under the misguided attitude that if you did that, then the record label would be invested and they would promote it more. But we did that, and they did their damnedest, but they also missed things. You know, when Lunatic Fringe was on the radio all the time, you couldn't find that record in stores when we'd be out on tour.
Now that's really surprising. You mean in the U.S.?
That really was.
That's shocking, was, actually, because yeah, that was everywhere.
And it was frustrating because we were playing, you know, we were opening for Kinks, Doobie Brothers, Jefferson Starship, REO Speedwagon, goes on and on. And so we're playing to 15, 17,000 people every night. And the record stores have maybe two or three copies, if that.
So during that time, did you get to meet any of your musical heroes? Because you're now in the limelight, right?
Oh, I mean, these all, you know, Ray Davies, that was an interesting time. But he, you know, he didn't really hang with us. Grace Slick was the best person ever.
She's still around. She just turned 80-something, 84, I think I saw.
84. And the first thing she said was, "You see this board? I want you to, every light to come on this thing. And you're going to be loud and proud. I turn on every light and turn up every amp." She said, "I'm not afraid you're going to upstage me. I have 10 hits. You have one."
What a comment to make.
I don't have a crush on her anymore after that comment.
Oh, I still have a crush on her. She would come every night. We were out with her for over 2 weeks, and every night she would come early to hear Lunatic Fringe and stand side stage to hear Lunatic Fringe.
Really? That's cool.
This is separate, but it's a quick Ray Daniels story for you.
Yes, please.
I don't want to step on no Ray Daniels. He's big time. He'll crush me like a bug. But this same manager that we had with this other band tried to get us to sign a management contract, and he wanted to negotiate a record deal, but we already had a record deal. So we passed on that, and we started looking for management, and we had a meeting with Ray Daniels. And he wanted the same. Well, he wanted a larger percentage than all the other people we spoke to. He wanted the publishing, and he wanted to renegotiate our record deal to go through Anthem, with him as the production company, and renegotiate our deal with Capital US.
Wow, that's an interesting story. Because obviously Rush, that was their blueprint that they worked through him, through the Anthem label, and that lasted forever and ever. So he wanted to basically do the same for you guys. But of course, you know, I understand why you didn't do it as well, because you had a lot already going for yourselves, and that would have been a major undertaking. And maybe very disruptive.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And to start working on a deal all over again, the deal was signed. Anyway, so we moved on from Ray. And
well, then you made another album, the album Neruda. I think your touring at that point also went up to even a higher level, did it not? And were you still opening shows, or did you ever get to the point of where you were actually headlining shows?
We had a few headlining shows, not the 17,000 variety, but 2,000 to 5,000 seaters. We had some headlining shows. We spent a lot of time with that record opening for Pat Benatar, who was excellent.
Hit Me With Your Best Shot.
Yeah, yeah.
Massive hit.
And she was fantastic, and her people were fantastic. That was a great time for us. And we spun off of that tour and had a couple of smaller headlining shows. And then we had your band as an opener on Neruda tour in Canada.
Honeymoon Suite.
Yes, sir.
Ah, interesting. Yes.
I have a question for you, Tom.
Absolutely.
Did you produce Feel It Again?
No, I produced the entire first record, and the second one was by Bruce Fairburn, who unfortunately passed way too early. So I did the first record, and then I actually came back and did an album with them maybe 15 or 20 years later called Clifton Hill. And then I managed the band as well for about 5 or 6 or 7 years, something like that. So I came back. Yeah. So I was there in the beginning. But for a variety of reasons, the band had done very well with the first record I produced. And then Bruce Fairburn was on a real roll with Aerosmith and some others. So that's okay. I have no hard feelings. And I've had Derry on the show and all is good. It's business at the end of the day. And, it certainly catapulted my career, and the band went off to do great touring, and they're still out there. So I forgot about that tour that they also, they probably opened for almost everybody in the beginning. And, that is the way to obviously move up the ladder.
And they were great. And that new
they're great people.
Now,
yeah, they're great people too.
Great people, still really good friends to this day. I love
them all. They're all great. And then you ended up with Gowan, who I'm a huge fan of. How did that hookup happen? And did you also tour with Gowan? And if so, how many years did that last? Did you make 5?
No, that was also about 4 years.
Okay.
So Ken Greer was still with Tom in the renamed Tom Cochran and Red Rider for a couple of albums after I was out of the picture. Then he and Tom, before the Mad Mad World album, which included the illustrious Life's the Highway, I think Kenny may have told him, "That song sucks, don't bother with it." sort of.
Well, I'm going to use the word colossal hit for that one. That one was worldwide, wow.
Yeah.
Wish I had the publishing on that one.
There was a lot of back and forth about what Ken's role would be, and would he accept just being a sideman guitarist after he had been a partner. So Ken basically said, "No thanks, I'm out." And then shortly after, he started playing with Gowan. They played on the great record All the Lovers in the World.
Yes, that was his biggest one, wasn't it?
It was a big song for Larry. Not probably as big as Strange Animal or Criminal Mind, but then in the next group, it was a pretty big record.
Yeah. And you weren't on any of those recordings, Gowan?
Wasn't on those recordings, but I did do some recording with Larry. I think what was the record? I can't even remember the name of the record. I have a gold record for one that I worked on with Larry that I did the tour, so I did all the touring. Basically, Peter Fredette was the singing bass player of that iteration of Gowan. Then he rejoined Kim Mitchell. And that's when Larry called me and said, and I had known him for a long time, but we had never played together. And he said, "Hey, Peter's got to go back with Kim Mitchell. I need a guy that can sing, and you want to do it?"
Mm-hmm. Perfect timing again for you.
Yeah.
Okay, so you did 4 years there, and then you actually released a solo album. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think you've only released one for some reason.
Thank you.
So you released a solo album in 2001. Tell us about that. And why have you not done more solo work?
What happened was after, so Gowan went by 98, 99, then he stopped touring as Gowan and joined Styx.
Of course. Yeah, where he still is today, doing an amazing job there.
Yeah. So all during that time, we also had the Carpet Frogs started in about 1994. And we had a couple of records out. But at any rate, once Gowan stopped touring as Gowan, I was doing back to the circuit and picking up sessions here and there. And then I met my wife, who she's in the film business, so she's more familiar with the creative process. And she said, you know, if you have a chance to, you know, record your own record, why don't you go ahead? You've never done it. Just go ahead. And we did, and it had one song that hit over 40 Canadian stations and was screaming up the chart when September 11, 2001 occurred.
Oh.
And then no one was answering their phone. Everyone was shell-shocked. You know, Jamie Vernon, who has Bullseye Records, that released that album and really helped me put that together. Ken Greer produced it. We did everything together on that. And this thing is screaming up the charts. And then for 6 weeks, everything went stagnant.
It did.
Because everyone was so shell-shocked.
Well, you've had great timing up till now, Jeff. You've been in the right place at the right time, except for this. As soon as you put a solo record out, boom, you know, some buildings go down and the world shuts down. Which affected all of us. Okay, so that's when you did the one solo album. And then, I think it was 2003, you returned back to work with Tom Cochran, and I'd love to hear how that came about. Did your phone just ring, and was this a total surprise for you that, oh, this is Tom on the phone, you know, would you like to come back? How did that happen? It was around 2003, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and actually we did a litmus test in the summer of 02, of 6 or 7 shows, because we did play together, I think, in 1998. A guy that used to be a crew guy for us and a lot of bands, John Garish, God rest his soul, was murdered. And people came together to do a little, memorial and, raise a bit of money for his kids. And so we did this thing, and Kenny and I and Tom played together for the first time in many years.
Well, obviously, your relationship obviously must have been amicable when you left, and you must have been all on good terms. But Tom must have felt there was something special about, having been in the studio and worked with a lot of acts in my career, there's always that chemistry. There's got to be something really special between when you walk in a room with him and you get on a stage, whether it's, small place or on a recording. There's obviously chemistry, and he's acknowledged that. And even if you're not best of friends, I know plenty of musicians out there that are playing together that are not best of friends, but they realize that if this person leaves the band, it ain't going to be the same. And on that note, I'm just going to say, I listened to the new Stones album 5 minutes ago before I came on. And with Charlie Watts on there, I'm just going to make a comment. It doesn't sound the same to me. It's chemistry. It's just a different thing. Now, all of a sudden, the production is really modern. And I just miss that sort of, I don't know, that again, I'll come back to that sort of dynamic that you can't get with other players, and that's where the magic occurs.
Exactly.
So I just thought I'd throw that in, that it's a special relationship that you have. And I'm just going to make a plug for Ken Greer, who also, by the way, has played on some productions of mine.
Yes.
And every single track he played on, he made it special and unique.
Yes.
So I got to give him a lot of credit, because sometimes he'd walk in and I'd be really searching for a part and going, what the hell can I put in this fucking chorus to make it stand out? Well, there's Ken Greer, shows up with his pedal steel with a bunch of delay and echo on it. Next thing I know, it's soaring in the clouds. I'm like, holy fuck, thank you. He just made me look good.
Yeah.
So I got to get a plug in there for him.
Oh, he's my buddy, and I love him. He's certainly...
he's a special talent, for sure.
He's a special talent. Yeah, so when Tom called both of us in 2002 and said, we played three songs in a thing a couple of years ago, what do you guys think of playing together again? Sure. So we did. And I think part of what sort of made Mike that solo album, without it being wildly successful, it gave me a credibility that I didn't have before.
Absolutely. And I've heard actually a couple of tracks before you came on here too, and I'm going to, give you some kudos there. It sounded really good, actually. I'm going to go back and listen to the whole thing.
Oh, thank you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so it was, I kind of feel like that kind of set me up for everything that was going to come next. So when Tom called, it was like, yeah, we could play. Let's see what happens. And then, of course, when we went in front of crowds, and you just saw the looks on their faces and how happy the crowds were and how much the notes that were coming, how much it meant to them to see the three of us doing it again together. It was amazing. And so we just kept going. 2003, we started to really work and do a lot of stuff.
So, Jeff, on a regular basis, you're still with Burton, right?
It's not really that limited a basis.
Not once a week?
No, it's it's random. Sometimes it's like we did a huge run in May and June in Western Canada.
Mm-hmm.
We did a smaller run in September. We did a smattering shows in the summer.
You've been on some recordings with Burton?
Yes, a few. Like, there's one big album that was 2008, 2009 called Above the Ground, all shows since. So I started playing with him New Year's Eve, the Millennium Night, 1999, shifting over to 2000. That's the first time we started playing with him. And the Carpet Frogs, our band, has been his band ever since then.
How about that blue, blue sky?
So Tom, just jumping in here, I think we're up to 2023 by now. I just want to tell Jeff, first of all, that congratulations on reaching the 70 club.
Thank you.
I'm clapping over here. I'm clapping.
I mean, how many of us thought we'd make that age when we're in our teens, right? But no, kudos to you, Jeff, because honestly, you are one of the very few musicians that I know that are still making a decent living out of playing music. My hat's off to you, buddy.
Wait a minute, let me look. A decent living?
Yeah, I think you may have to replace that word with okay. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe it's better than what we're thinking.
This is one of the best things in my life right here.
Well, there's the best things in my life.
It's my Sheryl Crow acoustic, buddy.
Really?
Yep.
Signed?
Yep. Oh, God, I love that thing. And I've been doing a lot of acoustic shows the last few years as a duo with Jerry Finn.
Yeah, mention that a bit, because I saw that advertised somewhere. You're playing around every once in a while.
Yeah, we do. We play a few small venues around. Last year, we did a big food bank thing in Windsor for 2 days, played a couple of venues. We're basically two guys with big jumbo Gibsons, and we play an assortment of covers, original, and a couple of Tom Cochran songs thrown in there. So Jerry is sort of known as the guitarist for the Killer Dwarfs, but he is so fantastic on acoustic, and does this thing called the Rowdy Men with George Maswell, who was the lead in Come From Away, the musical about Gander Newfoundland. So those guys have a thing. I played a bit on their record and stuff, but so they do traditional Newfoundland music. So Jerry is just, he can play any kind of music on any kind of guitar. We just laugh and have fun, and it's been growing.
Well, Harry, me and you should be going and checking this out, because we're due for a night out together to see some music.
I asked him on the media, I asked Jeff one time, I said, when are you going to play out this side of Toronto? I mean, they always seem to be out in Hamilton and that area there. And I said, come out to Whipping and Oshawa.
Okay, I gotta get something moving out toward Ajax, Whitney. Whitney Good.
Would be, yeah.
I'll see what I can do.
Yeah.
You only have to give me 50% of everything you make. Oh, wait, does that sound familiar?
And Harry, there's always a few questions you wanted to ask from... again, back to lactic acid days.
Yeah, I got a couple of personal questions.
Yeah, go for it.
So do you remember the Battle of the Bands we played at the CNE?
Would you like to hear my take of it?
Sure.
So it's another one of those vivid memories and something that I will always cherish. So all the bands, wasn't there a band called Freedom Train?
Yes.
Yeah.
And there was another guy from Leaside named Paul Shumka.
Yeah.
His band was the Sovereigns.
The Sovereigns, yeah.
And they used to wear, you know, shirts with collars. And they used to, you know, they were kind of, not, I don't know how to describe it, rigid, poppy, you know, bands. Mm-hmm. Other bands that were on that CNE Battle of the Bands. And I can remember us, we weren't really one of those bands.
No.
We were not that kind of a band. And feedback did happen. And I remember us coming in, and they put a piece of paper out that said, you know, You're not allowed to change the volume setting. Fender has provided amps for everyone, and you cannot change the volume. They're set at 3 or 4, and you're not to move that volume knob. And there's a piece of tape on there. And I remember us looking at each other and going, yeah, right. And then starting to play and just... I think we started with The Train Is Bringing My Mind Back to Me.
Yeah.
John Plant's opus to drug abuse. And
we ended with I'm a Man by the Yardbirds.
Right.
Oh, I used to play that too. Love that.
Right. Yeah,
I remember running the mic stand along my guitar thing. And we just cranked the volume right up.
Right, right. So all those amps were holding on for dear life, because there was feedback from even the bass amp. We get the bass amp to feedback. We were making some noise.
So it sounds like you had a lot of unwanted feedback join you.
It was probably one of my best solos.
It was so, like, we were just like, because I remember We used to watch The Move. Remember that? And there was feedback and breaking shit, you know. And I just remember doing that set and them going, well, you know, you're disqualified, right? Because you moved the volume knobs.
You are disqualified? And, you're kidding.
Yeah, the California got us.
Oh.
Because we changed the volume.
Oh, shit.
You didn't sound like the other bands at all. But the crowd is going nuts because it was exciting and it was rough and just a bunch of guys with scarves on, like squealing feedback, and John Plant, you know, strutting around the stage like a peacock. And people were going insane. And we went, that's okay. It doesn't matter if we're disqualified. Do you think they're going to remember any of these other bands?
Oh, no. They remembered us for sure. And we got the booby prize of being chased down the C&E by, was it Myra? Moira?
Myra.
Myra.
These are my boys. This is my band.
Well, it sounds like a fun evening.
Oh, it was.
Wow.
So what's your secret for being able to do this for so long? Is it because you were at the right place at the right time, or just you're nonstop hustling?
Or how about you have to be a pretty good bass player?
Yeah.
I'll throw that in as well. I think you're pretty good. I'm kidding. Oh, I mean, you're exceptional, actually.
Oh, I still tell everybody he's one of the top three in Canada.
For sure. But I like that question, too. Yeah, so I'll echo that, too. Like, is it just your love of music and always being in the right place at the right time? Or, as Harry said, or is there any other particular secret? It's just, you know, your credibility has lasted, because when you were with some of the earlier bands, your cred continues forever.
Yeah, I mean, I always had... So some of it is the right place at the right time. Things happened. I even with Infidels, the bass player was going to be Dean Jarvis, who has been Nelly Furtado's music director for a million years. And he's a fantastic musician. But he didn't sing. And that's how I got the Infidel gig. So things like that happened all.
So there's a little bit of luck involved too, as long with your credibility and the fact that you must be a nice person to be around, because I know how important that is too, to not rock the boat when you're on tour with people. I'm sure you're a nice fella out there when you're in airports and stuff, and you're not too self-centered, we'll say, that you're always sort of looking at the big picture. Let's make sure this is a great evening.
Team first. I had a couple of things, you know, the luck. I was too stupid to quit.
But I can see you smiling still right now, like many years later. I think you've enjoyed your run from what I gather.
It's been phenomenal, and I probably wouldn't change it. I mean, my dad, when I went with Ocean, and he was like, you know, I'll pay for your university if you want to take that. And I didn't take that, and then we sold 3 million. And when things started to go bad over there, I didn't bail. I'm always the last to bail. I'll stay with the ship and I'll keep fighting.
Well, there's another adjective I'll throw in there to add to what I said earlier, is you're probably very loyal. Again, once you're in, you're in, and you give it 110%.
Yeah. And I'll do that with any person. If they show me trust, I'll give everything, and that only changes if you mess with me, then then I walk away. But anybody that treats me half civilly, hey, I'm gonna be warm.
Well, the key word for me is always respect. I've been doing this as long as you have, and you know, I use that word all the time. You respect me. I've spent a lot of time in the studio as a producer, et cetera. You respect me, and I respect you back. It's a mutual sort of admiration for each other and what we bring to the table. So, Harry, you had a very good question here that I want you to... it's the one about the retirement. Oh. Please... Yeah.
See, with me, it was when Mornington Drive broke up, I chose to go the straight life, so to speak,
right.
Because of my personal situation and all that.
And you can mention what you did. Be proud of it.
Of what?
Of what you went. Yeah. You chose not to go into music for other reasons.
Yeah, my wife was pregnant with my son, and there was no guarantees anywhere. That I were, you know, coming up towards me. I had an offer to go to LA, but there was no guarantees. It was to work with Goldie McJohn from Steppenwolf.
Right.
And I mean, it was very palatable. I would have loved to have done it, but there was no guarantees, and I couldn't take that chance. So I went the straight way, and, you know, I worked my way up in management with the LCBO, and I've done very well with retiring and getting a pension and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, you know, all those years later, now I'm back in the music business by writing and having my songs streamed.
Oh, because you don't have to think about, is this going to, you know, make it so that I can't make my whatever.
Exactly.
Well, that's
exactly.
That's a nice way to lead up to your question, Harry.
Yeah. So my question is, do you have a retirement plan at all?
Oh, God.
That's a loaded question.
Oh, God. No, I do not. Unfortunately, I'm just going to play until I drop. And no, I don't know. I hope that's not the case. I don't know how much longer I'll be as okay as I am now, physically, mentally. I'm fine. So I'm good to go.
Well, if the Stones can go to 80 and there's plenty in their 70s, like just, you know, there's a whole long list of them.
To varying degrees of that I want to see or not.
Yeah, I'm sure you probably don't want to go on an extensive 6-month tour playing six nights a week. I'm not sure that might be in your cards.
No, I don't. And I have no retirement plan because, you know, I've only done this, and I married someone also in the arts. She's a film editor.
Your retirement is probably just doing what you just said you were doing 5 minutes ago, which is playing with somebody like Jerry, having fun. Not. It's more of a chill gig. You don't have to jump on a plane every night.
I'm jumping on a plane Thursday. So
yeah, but it sounds like you have a nice balance right now. Like you're doing some of those, some of the other more low key things. You're sort of spreading yourself out, but it's manageable.
That's how I feel about it. Yeah, I don't think that I could do like a 6-week run now, or I could, but I don't really want. Sometimes when we get on a run, the thing about it is the hotels have gyms and you actually do work out.
Yeah, that's very cool.
So that's been very great. But no one that I play with really wants to be out for that long either.
I remember talking to you probably a couple of years ago, and you were in Florida playing with Burtons, and you had to fly home, change clothes and bases, whatever, and fly out west to play with Tom Cochran.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's been this whole, especially the last 10 or 15 years, both have worked more, and... Yeah, I've had to do some pretty crazy overnights to make it work. But, hey.
Well, it sounds like you don't mind slowing down a little bit, which some of the other...
I don't mind, but I like money as much as the next person. I'm not saying no to anything, but it just seems like we're all kind of settling into a place that's not a rut, but it is a place where there's less, nobody's doing, well, I got to get out. I got to get 2 4-week tours this next year. Nobody's doing that. So,
and the other way to look at what you're doing is, of course, you still have a passion for it. I'm sure you wouldn't do it. I mean, yes, you'd like the money, but I can tell that you still enjoy going up on a stage and getting the adulation of a crowd and having that special magic hour or two on a stage. You know, it's in you're a lifer. I have a lot of those that have been on the show so far, and I would definitely put you on my list.
Yeah, I guess I would be.
It's in your DNA, and you need it like a drug, a good drug.
Yeah, but you know what? For me, what's big, maybe bigger than, of course, the adulation of a crowd is something, but it's really the camaraderie of the people that I don't actually have to work with any assholes. So every person that I work with is actually a friend. And so it's a big deal to us when we get to a town, if the show's not till the next day, that we can go out to dinner together. We can catch up.
I'll echo what you just said, because in my my small world outside of the music business, I also play tennis with a bunch of guys, and it's all about the camaraderie. We love the court stuff, which is comparable to what you're doing on stage, but we love the post tennis just as much, if not more, because yes. You get to hang out with your friends and they become friends over the years.
Yes. Yes. You know, with Tom, especially this last few years, cause we're the same age. He just turned 70. For the past, I don't know how many years, when we're walking onto a stage, he always looks at me and says, can you believe that we still get to do this and somebody actually wants to hear it?
Yeah, it's amazing, really.
It's unbelievable.
It is. This has been really enjoyable. And Harry, let's go out and see Jeff perform.
Well, yeah, it's funny because Jeff and I... Well, I'm pretty.
And maybe you can do a lactic acid song. You can learn one and do one together.
Right. We'll do the one I used to sing.
With feedback. Throw the feedback in as well, please.
What was the song you sang, Harry?
Little Black Egg.
Oh, yes.
By the Nightcrawlers or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Come on, guys, work on it for me and stick the feedback in and let me know when you're playing it live. I'll be there.
Okay, well, I'll definitely reach when I have anything that's in the area. Like, we do go to that Noonan's up on Danforth every month.
Hit me up, because I'm in that area quite often, actually. I would love to come down. Okay, guys, it's been fun, lots of fun. I've really enjoyed this, and thanks for coming on the Talk Music Podcast. And see you guys around.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it a lot, Tom and Harry.
Okay, thank you guys.
Amazing, guys.
Okay, see you around. Bye-bye.
Take care.